welcome to Big Blend Radio's Food, Wine, and Travel Show, where we go across country and travel the world with members of the International Food, Wine, Travel Writers Association. Let's go. Everybody, welcome. We are excited. Today, we are going to go on what is a magical tour of Morocco with travel writer and photographer Barbara Redding. And Barbara, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, excited. We've got your story up on blendradioandtv.com, so everyone can get that in the show notes. So just check the link out there. But going to Morocco, I know you've done a lot of travel writing. And this started out as like a 3-day stay. And you're like, why am I going all the way there for 3 days? It takes 3 days to get there.
Right.
So you kind of extended your stay a little bit.
I did. And it was so worth it. Some of the other, I was with just a small group of travel writers. There were two others and they had to turn around and go back home. And they were so jealous that I had the opportunity to put together different additional trips that allowed me to stay for really 3 weeks. So it was it was great. I mean, you can always stay longer in places and learn more, but 3 weeks was a great amount of time. I felt real fortunate to be able to do that.
Have you been to Morocco before or anywhere in that region?
I have been to Egypt, but had never been to Morocco and had been on my list for a while. I had actually had a trip planned during COVID with a girlfriend of mine, and COVID, they shut down the whole country, so we couldn't get in. That's why I had it on my mind and, you know, was looking for an opportunity to go. And when the press trip came up to Tangiers, to the Fairmont Hotel, I just jumped on it with both feet.
You're like, I'm in, I'm going. So Tangiers, now tell everybody about that region. I mean, like, let's, and the background behind me. So that is the Sahara Desert, right?
Yes, it is.
Iconic Sahara Desert.
Exactly. And that was, wow. It was, that part of the trip was amazing. But I started in Tangier, which is a fascinating city in its, you know, in its own. And during World War II, it was kind of the place where, you know, the adventurous type spies and people on the run ended up in Tangiers because it was kind of wide open. It was kind of managed by different European countries. And so it was considered wide open at the time. So it was kind of a wild place. And so today it still has some of the remnants of that. And I stayed in what used to be what was intended to be a palace built by an advisor to the Sultan, but the politics changed and he was never able to finish it. And it sat there for almost 100 years before the Fairmont Company decided to make it into a 5-star hotel. And it really is quite spectacular.
It's really quite lavish. When I look at it, it's kind of, things are lavish. And then at the same time, an artistic and attention to detail, it seems to be with everything, even the tea glasses in your photography. I was like, you know, we always drink tea in cups and saucers here. Well, today I have a mug. So sorry. Oh, you can't even see it. But I have a mug of tea, but you need it if you do a lot of podcasting. But it's kind of interesting to look at all the attention to detail and the colors. And then you'll go to a market, which we'll go, well, why isn't everything bagged and plasticky like we have, right? So it's kind of this opposite of experiences, it seems.
Yeah, it's a very colorful place, and really throughout the whole country. I mean, some places more so. And I mean, you have the backdrop of the Sahara Desert behind you, but it's really, you know, that's maybe in terms of the color, that's a pretty uniform color. But everywhere else, you've got bright reds and blues and greens. And, you know, it's just a really dynamic place in terms of the colors that they use in everything from the clothing to the teacups to the clothes that people wear. It's just a very, very colorful place, which is what, you know, I think one of the things that makes it so interesting. In Tangiers, like, all the buildings are actually painted white. Its nickname is the White City, but when you go to the markets, you know, there are colorful scarves and everything is kind of so dynamic set against that white background.
Yeah, you know, but the desert is like that, you know, about the desert areas are like that. And then it's kind of interesting because when you have those kind of tones, then you do want to liven it up a little bit with different colors. So it's kind of interesting, but a lot of it is also even the food and the spices have that color, you know, and I think that, and the tea, you had the tea, you did the tea.
Yes.
I'm jealous about the tea. I wanted to go to Morocco specifically for the markets and the tea. 100%.
Well,
I know there's camel rides and there's other places to stay and there's so much, but I want to go there for that. I mean, I think a lot of people think of that first, right? I don't know, maybe not.
Yeah, no, I think the tea is one of the things that people think about. And it is, I mean, Morocco is known for that. I don't think I really realized how much tea people drank, but you know, everywhere we went that there was always tea. And that was the first thing that they came up and asked you if you wanted it sweetened or if you wanted it, you know, unsweetened. And it, you know, part of the whole, I think the way that Moroccans welcome people to their homes or their restaurants is they serve tea. And I found that to be a very charming aspect of Morocco and particularly of the Moroccan people.
And so for you moving forward on this journey, there's the teas. So it's like as soon as you like land, you have to start learning this culture immediately, right? And that's part of being a travel journalist is, okay, now there's tea. Is there going to be tea in the next place? Or is it the whole area? You know what I mean? So you have to start picking up those customs. I mean, were you even worried, like, what about the language and getting around? And did I pack the right clothes because it snowed in the Atlas Mountains while you were there? So, I mean, the acclimation part of this, what was that like? Because even the markets, I grew up in Africa and in the markets there, like, dude, seriously? You better be able to handle everybody pressed against your body.
Yes, it's, I think that's,
if
definitely
you're a loner and meet company, go to a market.
Yes, there's so much to see and smell and experience in the markets of Morocco. That's for sure. In terms of preparation, I went in January, which is not the ideal time. I think generally in Morocco, you probably want to avoid the winter and the summer because it can be very hot. But on the one hand, being there in January, I did need, you know, kind of a warm coat and maybe more clothes than you would need in the summer. But it was a wonderful time to go because there were so few other tourists. And so it was really kind of, you know, a unique opportunity to be in places. I mean, there were still a lot of people in Marrakesh, for sure, and in Fez and the markets, but not the kind of pressed together that you see in, you know, the more busier times of year. But I think you just kind of, you know, I looked at the temperatures, I dressed for that. I think it is a more conservative country than a lot of places. And so it's not the place that you're going to, you know, parade around in, you know, sleeveless tops and things like that. And as I said, it was cold, so I didn't even, that wasn't even tempting. But it is a conservative country, and a lot of people, particularly once we got into the mountains and the rural areas, I mean, they're wearing the traditional dress, men and women, some women covering their heads and faces, not all of them. But, you know, it is an Arab Muslim country, and so they are conservative. One of the reasons that you realize is that a lot of people drink tea is that they are not, alcohol is not something that is consumed by many in the Muslim culture. And so tea is the drink of choice in the evening for breakfast.
But they smoke, right, too? Don't they smoke?
Well, I mean, like everybody smokes. I mean, you see people smoking, but it's not, I don't remember it being, you know, overwhelming. I mean, they do have, I guess you're talking about the hookah bars where you can go in and do that. Yes. I mean, that's available, but it didn't seem that prevalent, at least where I was.
So the tea was the main thing. So when you were there, I mean, so what about for travelers? Is like, that's it. If you like your wine at night, get over it. Or can you get wine?
Well, most most of the restaurants that you know, house Western tourists do have wine and beer and some, you know, some hard liquor too. It's not, and one of the things I was surprised to learn that actually in Morocco, there are some vineyards in Morocco and some wineries. Apparently they were left over from, well, that I guess when the Romans were there, many in the first century, they planted a vineyards. And then of course the French were very involved in Morocco over the years. And of course, you know, the French like their wine. And so they planted vineyards as well. So it's not a perfect climate for wine growing, but I was pleasantly surprised by some of the wines that we had with our meals. So if you walk into a restaurant, you know, maybe mostly serving locals, you may not have access to wine, but if you're staying in a Western hotel, or you know, as with the group, you will in most cases be able to have a drink.
Well, and you know, being a Muslim country, you also want to be very respectful. And it's a very interesting time for us, even, you know, covering Muslim content. To me, I just want to just put a thing out there for folks to remember: each person is individual, and maybe talk to people individually and not place anything on anything. Like, you know what I mean? It's a very hard thing when you, as a traveler, travel writer, when you go to places and you see what's going on in the world, there is a compassion that comes with it. And so as we go now with what's happening in Israel and everything, do you feel a compassion? Not, I'm not saying to pick sides or anything, because that's not at all what I mean. But there's a bigger scope when you travel, and a bigger compassion that comes with it when you travel, of understanding that to embrace differences versus the other side.
Yes, and I think that Morocco as a country is one of those places that has a reputation for being very accepting of people of all religions and races, because of, you know, it's been a transit point. Europeans came. It's very close to Spain, so a lot of people came over from Spain and from France. So you have a lot of Europeans, and then you also have the original Berbers who were there before the basically the what they talk about, the Arabs who came from the east and settled in Morocco as well. So it has a big mix of religions and people, and a strong history of being very tolerant. And I thought that was one of the more interesting things about Morocco, that it is 95% Muslim, but there it's just everybody that we talk to is very accepting, and you know, it did not seem to be a country that was, you know, there was a lot of tension around that. Now, of course, I was there in January. Things have changed a bit given what's going on in other parts of the Middle East, as we know right now. But I found Morocco to be an incredibly welcoming and accepting place, and the people as well.
So, food, because all the colors of those spices, the lemons, the, you know, the mint tea, like, come on, what was some of the highlights for you food wise?
Oh, I love the food of Morocco. I mean, I've always...
Pomegranates. Ooh, sorry. I didn't bring that up too.
But I love eggplant. That became one of my favorite things. And they have a lot of eggplant in Morocco. And so they cook it in all different ways. So it's really one of my favorites. And olives. Olives everywhere. Just, I loved it, you know, stuffed, unstuffed, black, green, all different kinds of colors. You went into the market and it was just, you know, the colors were just amazing. But one of the most interesting things that we did on our trip, and I think others do on tours, is we had dinner with the family when we were in Fez. And so, you know, I think the woman of the household had some help. She didn't do all the cooking. And I think her husband helped too. But we just had an amazing home-cooked meal in the, you know, the traditional pot that they use in Morocco, with the tent now I'm blanking on the name, but a tagine.
Like a tagine. Yeah, tagine.
Yes. And so, you know, they brought it out to the table and it was this amazing chicken dish with lemon and olives that was just, oh, it was so good. And then one of the things, they're very big on vegetables. And so, you know, they had carrots, you know, about 5 or 6 different vegetable dishes.
I just want to say, but anybody watching this is looking at the desert behind me going, yeah, right. You carrots, you know, eggplant growing out there, maybe chicken somewhere, somehow. But I just want to say that there's different regions of Morocco.
Yes, yes. And I was going to say the coastal regions, I mean, they're, Morocco is big, a big farming country too. When you get closer to the, you know, outside the mountains and the desert, big farms. When we were on the bus driving through parts of Morocco, I was kind of amazed at the wheat fields and you know, various crops. Of course, they have lots of olive trees, but it's a very a verdant country in certain places. Now, the desert, not so much, but
I don't get medjool dates, maybe. As far as
dates.
I know, they come from
dates,
there.
Dates are everywhere, yeah. Too. I mean, I really enjoyed the cuisine, from the main courses to the fruits, the vegetables. They had some actually quite good desserts as well. So I, anybody who I think likes different types of food and is open to trying new things, I think Morocco is just a wonderful place to expand your taste buds.
Does it kind of go also towards the Mediterranean style of cuisine with it being so close to Spain? I mean, you brought up that point in your article that I think we forget about, that it's just not that far from, you know, Spain with the Rock of Gibraltar. Now, I want to go there because of the monkeys.
Right.
And because of a Bob Dylan song, but that's a whole other story. I'll travel just for Bob Dylan songs, because but I do Morocco just for the song, just so I can play it there. But you really bring it back home to us that, like, all of that is pretty close, and we forget that, you know.
It
you
is
think, like,
and so you
Morocco is in
it.
This far distant, but it's not. And I lived in South Africa and Kenya, so it actually was in the same continent, but you always kind of, oh, it's way up there, but it really wasn't that far from Kenya, like, well, for me now, but.
Right. Yeah. No, it's very close to Europe. And so there's a lot of European influences that you find there. Now, I also, after being in Morocco, went to Spain a couple months later. And it's amazing
how
similarities there are in the culture in Spain and in Morocco, because the Spanish were in Morocco for a while. And of course, the Arabs, that the Moors that lived in Spain until they were basically kicked out about the 12th century. So there's a lot of similar cultural things in both countries. Very interesting to kind of go between one and the other. And you can really get a sense of,
that's
you
cool,
know, food and culture and architecture and everything.
Now, so you like the food, obviously, right? Now, is there tea beyond the mint tea, or is it always the mint tea?
That's primarily what it is called. You
okay.
can get different kinds of tea. I mean, when I was staying at the Fairmont, they brought out a basket of tea. And so you had all kinds of choices. But if you go into the, you know, kind of a typical local restaurant, you're going to get the actual leaves of the tea, you know, in cups of hot water. So
awesome.
It's whatever is growing in that region. And they talk about it as being, you know, combining with the mint leaves. But as I said, I don't know that it's always mint tea everywhere, but it's probably the most prevalent.
It's very healthy.
Oh, it
it's
is.
Good for you. It's good for your digestion. It's good for your body. And it's a perk up. It's a
right.
little, and, you know.
I ended up bringing some back for sure.
I know. Cause once you have that taste, it's like, okay, you know, am I having wine or tea? Well, I don't
right.
know.
Right. You missed it. I missed it. Yeah, I've missed the food too. I mean, I've had some, you know, tried some Moroccan dishes at home with, you know, mixed success, but really did fall in love with the food for sure.
Well, you have a photo of the juicers in the market with all these pomegranates, and us in the Western culture look at pomegranates and go, Oh, hell no. We had to take all those seeds out. What you talking about, Willis? Like, we ain't doing all that work. I mean, yet over there, they're just like, here, you know, we know how to use our pomegranates and they're so healthy. So it seems that their food is pretty much on the healthy side in a lot of ways, with fruits and teas and, you know, that kind of thing, that eggplant, like you're saying. There's a healthy, good, I mean, I don't know if they're in a blue zone or not, but it feels like they could be.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that either, but I would say yes, very, you know, Mediterranean, and obviously mm-hmm. they are much of the country is on the Mediterranean, and the climate is similar to, you know, France and Spain and other countries along. Mm-hmm. So they have a lot of, you know, they grow a lot of the same foods and fix them in, you know, different ways, but similar ways. So I think there's, I consider their cuisine quite healthy.
So now let's talk about your lodgings, because you did like quite a few days there. Like you went over a week or how many weeks? How long were you there?
3 weeks. 3 weeks.
That's what I thought. 3 weeks. I don't have all my notes in front of me, but 3 weeks. That's what I thought. I was like, oh, she went from 3 days to 3 weeks. She expanded. She worked it. She's like, I'm going. What were the lodgings like for you?
Well, as I said, I started out in Fairmont, so that was kind of my luxury accommodation. So it was beautiful. I had my own like balcony overlooking, you know, the city, and it's just a gorgeous 5-star hotel. There's no doubt about it. And they had several different restaurants. I mean, it was, and they had their own spa and, you know, gym. I mean, it was a deluxe accommodation. Now, so I spent, I guess, 4 nights there, 3 days. And then from there, I arranged my own trip because I really wanted to see Chef Schoen, which is known as the Blue City. All of the walls are painted various shades of blue for the reasons for that are, you know, people disagree on exactly the reasons why it's so blue. But I was fascinated to go there. And so arranged my own transportation and found what they call a riad. And a riad is kind of an older traditional home with a courtyard in the middle. And it's, you know, they're popular throughout Morocco and some other Middle Eastern countries. And often they have a, what's called a hammam, which is where you can get kind of a special bath. And so I was excited to try a hammam because that was something I had never been. I've had massages, I've had scrubs, I've had various kind of spa treatments, but hammams are different. And so that was one of the reasons I wanted to stay in the riad. But the riad was quite nice too. I mean, nice hotel rooms. But in the middle was kind of a courtyard and a swimming pool. And then they had like, you know, what we would describe as a spa area. But so I signed up for the hammam, which is a form of a steam bath. And then mm-hmm. you have an attendant that scrubs you down from head to toe with like a, it's not a Brillo pad, but, you know, with, it's a very kind of cleansing process involving a couple different things like the steam, you get cold water, you get hot water, and it's a very rejuvenating process. And that's one of the things that riads often
they're
have.
They're opening your pores. They're taking all your junk out.
Exactly.
They're cleaning it up. Yeah.
A cleansing experience. And in Morocco, a lot of places, even today, do not have their own, you know, baths and running water. And so there are public hammams where people go and actually scrub each other. Now, I wasn't quite ready for that. I thought I would prefer a private hammam experience. And so that's what I signed up for, the riad. But it was a beautiful place, and really loved everything about it, from the food there to the experience. And then from there, I joined the Gate One tour. And so we were mostly staying in kind of Western style hotels wherever we went. But when we went to the desert, we stayed in a really interesting kind of an African style, you being having grown up in Africa, I might, you know, kind of recognize it. And just, you know, beams, and it was just in the desert. I mean, you really felt like you were kind of out there. And, you know, the architecture was like a kind of a sand castle. And like an oasis in the middle. I mean, it was probably most of the places where you do stop once you get to the desert are or were oases, because they were the only places that had water, and that's where people ended up. Now, these days, obviously, you know, there are Western style buildings and you have better access to water and you know, other things, but it really was quite a more one of the most exotic places that we stayed. I would have loved to have done a tent stay. A lot of trips to Morocco mm-hmm. do include sleeping in the desert, but because I was here in January, that wasn't one of the options.
That was a little cold. I was going to say, because I know desert nights get chilly, you know. Yeah, and you're in Texas, you know, you're not quite in the desert, but you're in that hillside area where it can get cold at night. It really can. And I agree with you, but I love the tent styles, you know, going out there, but it also gets windy. That's part of the problem with the desert is the wind. It's not necessarily even the heat. It's the wind, you know, going out. Yeah.
And in looking at the landscape behind you, which is one of my pictures, I mean, you think that's what the wind did to the sand. It sculpts it into these amazing.
It's beautiful. You know, and they've got little lizards that go in and out and do all kinds of things inside. There's all kinds of critters in there, which I don't want to freak people out on, but I think it's cool. But going out, you went on camel. So was that your first camel ride, or have you been?
I had actually ridden the camel in Egypt, but it had been a few years ago. And the camels of Egypt are much bigger, taller than
That's interesting.
I know. I didn't realize that either.
Yeah.
We did learn about, you know, the various sizes of the camels and why. But so our camels were shorter, but that was still a fascinating experience. It was part of the experience that we got into, like, basically sand buggies and then rode out into the desert and to this camel ranch, I guess you would call it. And that's where we met up with, you know, kind of our camel handlers and got on the camels and then rode up to, you know, into the landscape that's behind you and for the sunset. So
well,
you
got the colors, which was like, you know, because it could be, you know, your time of day is important for the desert. Seriously. Uh-huh.
Right. So they timed it so that we would be kind of up on, you know, one of the sand dunes in time to watch the sunset, which was quite spectacular. But we did start out being kind of hot. Then by the time we got up there in the sunset, it was really cold, because in some ways you were kind of like, wow, I want to spend more time in the desert. Once the sun went down in January, it is really cold. So
you're like, I want to go back to my Western lodgings now.
Right. Well, that was kind of the way it turned out. So as I said, by the time it was time to return, I think we were as happy as the camels to go back to the camel ranch. And
camels are like, I want my food now. That's enough. I want to ask about tips for people planning a trip to Morocco. Because you worked on your own thing. I know as travel writers, you know, we work with a lot of CVBs, destinations, and work on itineraries with them. But it's different for those going out on their own. Would you say go with an excursion company, travel guides, or go for it on your own? If this is your first time traveling overseas, you may want to go with an excursion company, maybe. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Morocco is, because of the language issues, I mean, a lot of people do speak English, but it's, you know, I think particularly your first time, I would definitely recommend a tour guide. It's also getting from place to place can be complicated. I did ride the train on my own, but I remember trying to get my ticket out of the booth, and I finally just gave up and stood in line, which was kind of long, to actually talk to somebody who I thought would speak English, who could help me make sure that I got on the right train. So it turns out I did, and it was all fine. I think I could go back and be just fine on my own. But, you know, it's a little more, well, I would say more than a little more comfortable to have someone else taking care of the arrangements. Morocco in some ways is very modern, in other ways it is not. And so it's also, you know, a country that where people are doing well and people are not doing so well. And so there are lots of street vendors. I did not find them to be harassing, but I think some people do. And particularly, I think maybe younger women in particular may have, you know, be more likely to be hassled in the markets where there's a lot of activity going on.
So it's also about our attitude, how we go in.
Right. And I mean, I was never worried or felt unsafe. But I think that it's a matter of comfort, and that probably the first time being with a group and having a guide making, you know, some of the decisions about where to stay and what to do when, and all of those kinds of things would just make it easier.
I think for single women traveling, that's a good point of, you know, so many people retire now and they're like, okay, we're going to hit our bucket list. And if you didn't have time to travel internationally outside of major city, easy air flight in and out kind of thing, you know what I mean? You could have traveled for business and hit a few highlights, but not really traveled. You know what I mean? For the travel experience. I think sometimes getting the guides can help you. And once you to get your travel feet going, it's like a new, it's like almost having a new job. Mm-hmm. A new career, because right. travel is tiring, and I'm not discouraging people. I'm just saying you want to have the best experience. I think the first few times you go internationally, I think go with a group or go mm-hmm. with a tour guide help or somebody to guide you through the process, so that you, especially if you're going to places like Morocco, even Egypt, you know, and Egypt, you know, I'm sure is not that remote, but it's, you know, I just think you should have some help along the way for your first few times until you get your sea legs, you know, your travel legs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that Morocco is pretty exotic in comparison.
And it doesn't matter what age, by the way. I was talking about people retiring. They've got a lot more experience, but I mean, the first time, and especially because we have so many women travelers now that are going solo.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I was solo in a group. So I was totally solo when I went to Chef Schoen. But, you know, the other times I was traveling with other people that, you know, we could share the experience with, as well as, you know, just get additional information. And I think our guide, for example, on the Gate One tour grew up in Morocco. He had studied in Paris, a very interesting man who gave us a lot more insight into the country and its history than maybe we would have gotten on our own, for example. So I think that a good tour guide can really enhance your experience, you know, in a place where that's, you know, when Morocco is pretty exotic for a lot of American travelers. So
I agree. So,
It's not, we don't get a lot of Moroccan history in our history books. No. So I think it was, Mohammed was a wonderful resource for us to learn more about Morocco.
And you're hearing it from a local, you know, mm-hmm. and who knows, you know, little things that you're not going to always get on Google. Like Google's good, but like not for everything. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying. There's nothing like the in-person real experience. Barbara, for you, I want to kind of touch on your travel writing, because I know you've traveled the world, right? But you started out in actual journalism. So as a travel writer, travel journalist, there is a difference between a travel writer blogger versus a journalist kind of thing. But yet I think they're all connected. But a mm-hmm. journalist, having that journalistic background kind of makes you get to the heart of the story quicker. Like, you're not allowed to have all these extra frills. You know what I mean? Just the facts, ma'am. You know?
Right. Yes, that was my background, is just the facts, ma'am. But I do find that there is a lot more freedom in travel mm-hmm. writing to, you know, to just talk about more about what you're seeing. Now, again, as you know, traditional journalists and travel writers, we always have a space limit. You can't tell everything you did. So you have to make decisions about and prioritize the information that you have so that you're presenting it in a way that's interesting and educating to your readers. So I do think that my background probably, you know, imposes a bit of more discipline than maybe somebody who hasn't had to write on deadline, who hasn't had to write, you know, for about a, you know, specific, to fit a specific hole in a newspaper or a magazine, for example. But I think in some ways, travel writing is a little more free. You're freer to, you know, to write about the people.
But travel writing traditionally was more journalistic, like, don't put your feelings in. We don't want to know that you lost your scarf in this town or whatever. We know. And yet when you talk to people about travel, they want to hear those. They want the dirty stories. They want to know what went wrong. Have you found that too? People just actually want to know, like, well, we broke down and this really sucked. We didn't get to go to the bathroom for 10 hours because we were broke down here. They actually want those stories. It's right. Weird, isn't it? It's kind of that balance.
It is. And it's funny being, you know, having been in those situations too. I had an amazing trip to Europe. We ended up then going flying from Greece to Cairo and decided to go from there. This was a few years ago and went from there to Israel. And we ended up in a taxi cab going across the Sinai. And when I was with one of my sisters and, you know, that was the most, I mean, Europe and everything else we did was pretty normal, but that taxi ride across the Sinai is something I will never forget. And it's one of my favorite travel stories to share with people because it's just, you know, you go to Paris and everything is fine, but it's those, as you said, the things that happen when you're.
And it's not funny when you're going through it. It's not funny. There's no fear. There's interesting language on all levels. And you get out of it, but that's the cocktail story, isn't it?
It is. That's what there were times when I thought we would be ending up spending the night in the desert and maybe no one would ever see us again. But that wasn't how the story ended, but it's a great travel tale. So I think you enjoy and remember those kinds of experiences more.
You know,
than
cocktail parties in South Africa, they would call all of us travelers Wenwies, because you'd have your drink in hand going, well, when we were here and when we did this, you know what I mean? That's what this nickname of Wenwie came up above. I was a kid at that point, not drinking the cocktails, but I would refill the cocktails for the adults and had my own cocktail. But anyway, that's what happened in those cultures, but in times. But I, you know, I find it fascinating going from journalism to travel writing. How many countries do you think you've been to now?
You know, I was afraid you were going to ask that and I was going to add it up, but I haven't.
Well, just ballpark.
Ballpark.
Well, I love that you don't add it up either, because it's almost like we travel full time doing all the parks, and I think we did 1500 in COVID. Don't ask me now, because eventually it's like all these little badges, which I think are great. But when I think when you get to just you're really living it, you're really living it.
Right. Yeah. I would say I'm probably in the 30 to 40 countries.
That's amazing, though. I mean, how many people get to five? You know, and we want people to go beyond that because it's truly living. So beyond that fear zone of crazy taxi rides and things like that, right? We've gone full circle in that. That's pretty good.
Right. Yeah, I feel very fortunate to have gotten to travel to as many countries as I have. And hopefully I've got quite a few more ahead of me.
What is it that keeps you going with it? What is it? The adventure? Is there the hotels? Is it the camel rides that gets you going? What is it?
It's always something different. I think that's, you know, it's everywhere I've been, there's always something different. I remember going to Seoul, South Korea. You know, that was totally a place that I had, you know, the experience was totally unique. And so it's kind of, I think that wherever you go, there is always something different about that location. And that's what drives you to the next place. Okay, I've been to China, but I haven't been to New Zealand. That's still on my list. So I've been to Australia, but not New Zealand. But there are things that are unique to New Zealand that you can't see in Australia. So you want to...
Yeah, every place is different. Every country, every neighborhood even in America is different. And there's always a story.
Yes, there's definitely always a story. And many times there's more stories than you can tell.
That's the problem. I have a hard time. You know, just before recording this with you, I was talking to our friend Victoria Chick, and she's an artist, and we were doing a thing on cemeteries. Uh-huh. And I just was like, every gravestone is a rabbit hole for me. And that sounds terrible, but it is, because it's someone's life. Mm-hmm. And now I want to know who this is. Now I'm going to have to do research. Now here comes the Google. Here's the find a grave. And next thing I know, I've totally forgotten that I was supposed to do something else on a deadline, because I want to know. Like, I want to know. And that is the problem we have as travelers and writers, is seeking and sharing these stories and editing them. And so I love that you have the journalism background to help you on this. Everyone, you can go to BarbaraRedding.com to keep up with Barbara's adventures. She's on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Also writes for Travel Weekly and TravelWeekly.com. Check that out. Also, the Food Wine Travel magazine for the International Food Wine Travel Writers Association, who we call IFTWA. You can go to IFWTWA.org. And I mean, I've known your name for a long time, and I think it's really watching all the social media things on IFTWA, hashtag IFWTWA. And I've always seen Barbara Redding. And I'm like, man, she gets around. You go, girl. So how long have you actually been a member? Because I just have known your name for like years. Or
I guess it's been about 3 or 4 years. I have actually, you know, had been a travel writer, but never, I always had a day job. And so travel writing was kind of a part-time gig for me. But I retired from my full-time job and started doing more travel writing. And then the pandemic hit, and a friend of mine told me about IFTWA. And so I decided to join. And so we were doing, at that time, no one was traveling. So we were basically writing about previous trips for the magazine and different publications. And so it was an opportunity to get to know people in IFTWA and to, you know, gave me another outlet for, you know, the things that I was writing, and a network of some pretty interesting people. I've always amazed when I go on IFTWA trips or travel with other groups, other people on press trips, how interesting at the lives of people who are travel writers really is. I think my friends think I've gone a lot of places, but I come back from my trips and say, hey, I just met somebody who's been to 60 countries.
I'm jealous. I want to go to all of them. And I want those experiences plus my own. Yeah,
exactly.
It's like, I always talk to travel writers. I'm like, I'm jealous of you in Morocco. But it's not a green with envy, evil jealousy. It's just like, dang, the bucket list must be filled. You must do it, the wish list or whatever you want to call it, right? You've got to keep going for it. So where's your next destination on a wish list? And where's the next real destination that you're going to?
Boy, I'm still kind of in the working on that. I have not done that much travel in Eastern Europe. And so I would like to go to Hungary, Poland, the Baltics. So I think those are kind of at the top of my list. Scandinavia is another area that I'm really interested in. I have relatives in Norway. And so one of my sisters has been to visit them. And I thought, gosh, I need to do that. So there are other places in the world I would like to go. And so I'm kind of working on my 2024 itinerary as we speak.
Well, I love that you bring that up, because I think there's so much family history travel that's happening now that we didn't really realize about like 5 years ago, even 5, 10 years ago. So many people are traveling to where their ancestors come from, because we're all spread around the world. We're all over the place now. Mm-hmm. So it's to go back in history and find who we are in a way, and just even be in the same footstep as someone is amazing.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. One of my other relatives was from Ireland, and having been able to go to Ireland several years ago and to some of the places where the family lived was, you know, was fascinating. I think
it's meaningful. There's a feeling to it, you know. And some places you go to, you just get a weird feeling anyway. And you always go, what was that? Like, there's this vibe you get. And then one day later, you'll like, not one day later, but like years later, you'll be finding something you like, oh, my relatives were there. That's weird. It's weird. It's happened to us. It's weird. It's trippy weird, but it's good stuff, you know. But hey, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. I haven't seen you around social media. It's so good to finally meet you. And I'm so glad that you're here. And everyone follow Barbara Redding on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and BarbaraRedding.com. And again, her article is up on BlendRadioAndTV.com and in the show notes. So stay tuned for that. And it will be in our magazine, our big weekly Blend magazine too. So I think we're going to have to do a special like North Africa, Middle East magazine, because we have so much content on this now. I think we're going to have to do something special.
It's an interesting part of the world. Well, thank you so much, Lisa. I've really enjoyed talking to you about Morocco and some of our shared life experiences as travelers too.
Well, cheers. Here's to mint tea. You can't see my cup, but yeah, cheers to tea.
I think I'm going to have some right after this too.
Oh, so, I have a feeling yours is going to be better than mine.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio's Food, Wine, and Travel Show, featuring members of the International Food, Wine, Travel Writers Association. We encourage you to visit their website, we say IFTWA, which is IFWTWA.org. You can also follow us at BigBlendRadio.com. Happy travels, everyone!